very beginning of the book, there's a mention of Jack Colum, quote, "Brenda, it doesn't exist," as one of the first four epigraphs to the very first poem. And since he wrote that, we've lost Jack.
Yes, we have.
Yeah. Yeah. What did he think didn't exist?
That moment was amazing. It was, I was at Naropa teaching for the week, and Jack was sitting next to me at, we were about to start a panel. I think we were going to be on the panel together, or maybe, maybe it was... I can't remember. Anyway, maybe it was somebody else's panel. But I was madly looking through my handbag for something. It was a protracted search. I mean, it was inappropriately long, because when I get obsessed with looking for something. So I started looking for something, and I said, "Jack, I can't find what I'm looking for." And he said, "Brenda, it doesn't exist." And I thought that was so, like, Jack, that's just not helpful. it's not going to be helpful. You're supposed to say, well, keep looking and, you know, center yourself and all the sort of, you know, bullshit that we tell each other. But he said, no, it doesn't exist. I loved that, but he gave me such, I didn't know him well. I just met him a few times, but I instantly clicked with him when we hung out.
Well, you both have a commitment to eco-poetics. He's associated with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you see his connection to eco-poetics? Did you know much about it?
Yeah, well, I know his work quite well, and the work that I've taught of his. You know, he's spontaneously joyful about his encounters with the non-human. And what I loved about, part of what I loved about his practice was that he had little inventions that he did. You know, he would do, it wasn't so much a kind of staging of the interaction between things as it was, you know, recording his way of being with other species, or, you know, he invented forms, and he was an inspiration for a lot of people in that way. It was very, you know, it was very natural, to use a corny, you know, word. But he had a very relaxed and process-oriented way of writing that I admired a lot, yeah. And I just loved his wit. I love his prose. I love his, I don't know what that bird is, but it's a very special bird right here. This bird right out here.
Oh.
I don't know what
with
this
the,
is.
With
yeah.
the light orange breast
yeah.
and the striped
yeah.
head.
And the striped head, and wow, this is a special guy. I wish Bob would come downstairs.
Nice visitation
right now.
Here.
Yeah. Hello there. What are you? You're just a fly through. Oh my goodness. You just came for the interview, huh? Oh, wow.
I think you wanted to know about eco-poetics.
He did want to know.
So, and how you define eco-poetics, maybe.
So eco-poetics, we did a conference at Point Reyes, the Geography of Hope, a few years ago, and Angela Hume, my colleague, former student and colleague, had a long interview with me and Bob and Jonathan Skinner and Evelyn Riley, and we talked for like an hour about what the word means. And I teach a whole class in it. And my latest way of thinking about it is worried nature poetry. I mean, when I try to tell my students, like, you know, this big, long, theoretical thing, what is eco-poetics? Well, it's like you used to go outside in nature to feel better. And so what's happened to us romantics? What's happened to us since, you know, the 1820s when Wordsworth would go out and with Coleridge and they'd take a walk and they'd feel better? I still go outside to feel better. You know, I almost always feel better. And honestly, if it can't provide the old, like, magical juice, like the British Romantics, at least there's some sense of that, that it's that the non-human has interesting other information, and it's, as Snyder says, very high quality information. That's what he calls poetry. But I think that that high quality information that we have from the non-human realities are just endlessly restorative. Endlessly restorative. It's not nothing to just still go out and have the interchange where you're like, you have a different way of making your breath than I do. And how is it an experience to be you? You know, that bird we just saw, like, what, how does it feel to be you instead of a Brenda, you know? But ecopoetics has to me, involve the sense of peril and endangerment that we have created. And I do feel like it's human cause that we're worried. So
something that goes beyond traditional nature poetry,
yeah,
with some kind of notion that we are at a crisis in human history where the biosphere is being endangered. So writing nice little poems about birds or sunsets or whatever is not enough, and it's not what you would consider ecopoetics.
Well, I mean, I think it. Yeah, in some ways reflecting the moment. I loved in that exchange that we had at Geography of Hope, Jonathan Skinner said something really cool. He said, a word like that is not a subject, it's a site of investigation. And I really loved that answer because what he meant by that was, you throw a word like ecopoetics out and then everyone has, you know, people are going to have theoretical answers, or they're going to refer to romantics, or they're going to not, you know, refer to theories, or, you know, Timothy Morton's no nature theory, you know, he has a long thing about no nature, which is really sort of a great and provocative theory, you know, that we create the idea of nature and then, you know, are surprised when it's not safe, you know. And I mean, it's not a separate thing. I mean, thinking that nature, like my student said one time when I taught the course, he said at the very end of the course, he said, I don't know, Professor Hillman, I still think, like, when I go up to Tahoe and I go skiing, like, that's what I consider nature to be. Like, this classroom, I kept telling them, like, okay, at some level, you know, I would have them do bug interviews on the rainy days at St. Mary's, you know, I'd have them go up and down the halls and they'd interview bugs, dead bugs included. And I'd, like, that's nature, you know, that dead bug there is, you know, that's part of the nature. And so we're not going to make this sort of separate world where we can, you know, we won't screw up that part, but we can screw up this part. And so I think the idea of separation of nature has been one of the things that people have started to talk about. The idea of separation of parks and, you know, and rural areas that are set asides, you know, is that okay to, like, make those separate as opposed to our, you know, our city and urban area that has no nature but that we can screw up.
Sort of an apartheid for nature.
Right, exactly. Or toxic dumps that we can screw up, you know. So it's the whole, in the site of investigation of that word, and also just thinking about what nature is, has brought on a whole new set of theories and conversations that have been very rich, and I think have allowed people like my student, even if he's still stubborn at the end of the semester, like, no, that's nature and I'm non-nature. You know, he's like, my textbook or my cell phone, non-nature, but, you know, out there is nature, and when I go out. So it's an important conversation to have, mm-hmm, like, at some level.
Could have been worse. Instead of going out skiing, he said, I feel I'm in nature when I'm going out shooting animals.
Oh, I know. Yeah. You know, no. And part of my work as an educator is to create that sense. I don't care what you call it, you know, the respect for the fact that everything is related is what I want to do as an educator. Like, don't tell me your toxic dump doesn't relate to your ski zone. Right. You know, it relates.